Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a growing network of people who believe the center of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ, and that learning to take love seriously is vital for how we practice discipleship, mission, and leadership. The Gravity Leadership Podcast explores, in practical ways, how to root our lives and our leadership in this love that holds all of us and everything together.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. My name is Ben Sternke. I'm one of your co-hosts. I'm here with Matt Tebbe.
I'm here, and I have a helper today.
Hey.
Helping us do this intro.
All right. Introduce yourself, helper. Hello.
What's your name?
The voice...
Celeste.
That's Celeste. Celeste is our new co-host for the podcast. Celeste.
Yep. Celeste,
do you have anything else to say?
Do you have anything else you want to tell us, Celeste?
Like what?
Well, we're introducing a podcast today, so what's going on in your world?
Well, I'm doing school, and I wrote a essay about Rosa Parks and Nelson Mandela.
Mandela. Yeah, she did write about their leadership and their courage, and what else?
Believing in themselves.
And they believed in themselves. Yeah,
very
she,
nice.
She came, I was doing a Gravity Leadership quote this morning, and she brought it into me and handed it to me, and then I read it, this essay. So she's busy at work. And,
busy at work. She's doing school. She's learning and writing about Rosa Parks and Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
And their leadership. This is great.
Yeah. And?
Well, I can't figure out a smooth way to slide right into speaking of Nelson Mandela, but no, it doesn't really work.
Rosa Parks.
Speaking of
you spell
leadership,
her name with letters. Courage? You know who else's name you spell with letters? Mako Nagasawa.
There you go.
And Mako joins us today, and he's written a book, his first book, although it's incredible this is his first book because he's written hundreds of thousands of words.
Stuff.
This guy.
Yeah, on his Anastasis
Center website. Yeah. But he wrote a book about abortion.
Yep. if that's an obscure topic that nobody's ever heard of. No, it's really good. It's really helpful. It's a lot of what sort of we're learning about, like, the history of why we even care about abortion. It was fascinating.
Yeah, how abortion became something for Christians to care about in America.
Yeah, yeah.
And why.
And it wasn't self-evident. I think I grew up thinking that it was just self-evident. Well, of course, this is important. And it is important. It's an important issue. But once you understand the history of how it became such a hugely important issue, especially in the evangelical and Catholic world, yeah, it just raises a lot of questions.
Yes.
And so Mako really helpfully leads us through those questions and talks about how, in a lot of ways, we might be shooting ourselves in the foot in the way that we approach this, because a lot of the assumptions we have about abortion are actually wrong.
Yeah.
So anyway, this is a great quick interview with Mako.
It's really good. And just to give you a peek behind the curtain here, we actually recorded this interview twice. Mm. The first time we tried to record it, we had massive technological snafus, problems, and we spent like 30 or 40 minutes having this chat, and it did not go well. And so then
we had to do it again.
Yeah. And I'm really glad we did.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Yep. So anyway, I think that's it. Besides announcing, we're always starting a new Gravity Leadership Academy cohorts. Mm-hmm. If you're interested in getting into one, we're starting one real soon. You've got one by the time this releases, it might be full.
It may have one spot left. We'll see.
Yeah.
Because I've got some people who live all over the world and time zones are lining up. So we'll figure out how to get it started.
Okay. If you're interested, just email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com and we'll hook you up with Gino. He'll know what to do. So, all right. That sound means that it's time to get the podcast started.
Yeah.
All right. Here we go. Thanks, man. All right, Mako Nagasawa, welcome back to the Gravity Leadership Podcast.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Christy.
Yes, we're all here to chat with Mako today. Mako, you are one of a few guests who have been on our podcast. This is maybe the third time. I didn't check this before we started, but maybe the third time. You joined us before to talk about power.
Right.
And then I think you talked about race. And today we're going to talk about abortion.
All the easy topics.
Yeah. So we give you the softballs, basically.
Basically, just listen to all the podcasts with Mako, and you'll know how to structure your VBS this summer.
That's exactly it.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Mako, just in case people are just tuning in, maybe they saw abortion in the title, and this is the first Gravity Leadership podcast episode they've ever listened to. Just maybe do a brief introduction to you and to what you get up to in a day.
Sure. So my name is Mako Nagasawa. I live in Boston with my wife and two biological kids and foster daughter. I am the director of a Christian education and curriculum writing organization called the Anastasis Center. And you could find that online. We do lots of evangelism tools and Bible studies and Christian ethics, like study and action curriculum, that's really rooted in some early church insights. And those specific insights are Christian restorative justice and healing atonement.
That's another topic. We get into that in some of the other episodes. So if you guys, maybe we'll link to those in the show notes if you're interested in hearing a little bit more about healing, atonement, and Christian restorative justice. This is probably why we have you on the, like, just hearing those words, I'm like, yes, let's talk about that. We're not here to talk about that. This is probably why we keep having you on.
Hold yourself together.
You resonate. I know. I'm getting too excited. I'm going off in all kinds of directions here. Mako, but today we want to talk about a book you've recently written. Yes.
Yes.
The book is on abortion, and it's called Abortion Policy and Christian Social Ethics in the United States. So it's a bit of a more of an academic book. We wanted to have you on to talk about this issue because when it comes to abortion, I think a lot of our listeners probably grew up in environments similar to my environment growing up, which was I was in the pro-life movement. You know, we did march for life, you know, things like that. It was a very clear black and white moral issue for the church that the unborn, like this is perhaps the premier sort of moral evil in the United States, and we have to do everything we can to stop abortions from happening and from this evil to kind of come. And you're into the daily life of our lives of Americans as Americans. And your book seeks to complexify the issue a bit, essentially.
Right.
And so you write to say, hey, I think we've actually misplaced our priorities, those of us in the pro-life movement, and we have oversimplified something that is actually a more complex issue than we have made it out to be.
Right.
So before we get into those complexifications, I wondered, like, why did you want to write this book? Like, why complexify an issue that feels like a fairly simple
black and
moral
white
issue? Yeah.
Right.
Why complexify this in the first place? Why did you find it important to write this book?
I think first and foremost, I care about the issue, as I think many people do. And yet, mm-hmm. the more I read about some of the history of the pro-life movement, the more I came to wonder, why is the policy platform the way it is today? You know, so and I really felt like this is starting to become self-defeating, you know, because the way that economic conservatism is tied into the pro-life movement and kind of an anti-communism platform is tied into the pro-life movement, it makes it actually the abortion rate will be driven up higher because of the ways that those kind of policy agendas are put together. So, for instance, in the 1930s, it was the Catholics who anchored the pro-life movement, but they were New Deal Democrats, and they were very much for anti-poverty measures, strong, you know, small business focus, labor focus. And why is that? Because during the Great Depression, they saw the abortion rate skyrocket. And so to them, poverty causes abortion. But, you know, later, decades later, when... and we could talk about why this happened, but when the pro-life movement was adopted within the Republican Party, it was wedded to kind of Reagan's anti-communist platform, right? Mm-hmm. And the story was told, well, why do abortions happen? Why do people get abortions? And the story was told in such a way that it was, the answer was because of people aren't Christian or Christian enough. Right. And so it's atheism that causes abortion, which was not true. I mean, historically, it's never been true. And so but that fit into the Cold War rhetoric and that fit into this tendency to portray people like Dr. Martin Luther King as communist or Marxist. And we were never sure, you know, when you say someone is communist, do you mean that they're atheist or you mean that they're actually for, you know, a government role in providing social welfare and regulation and public investment and infrastructure. Yeah. But that was very clever because it meant both things. And so, you know,
you can mean whatever you want.
It can. And
for your political purposes.
Yeah. Right. And so, you know, when you look at abortion statistics, it's, you know, women between the ages of 18 to 29 who have the most abortions and women at or below the poverty line have three times the number of abortions as women who are not in the poverty category. So, you know, poverty causes abortions still, but there is something on the Republican side of thinking about this that says, no, poverty should be the scare tactic. It's the threat and it's the consequence for having kids before you're ready and having sex before you're ready.
Yeah. So they sort of reversed, they moralized poverty and abortion kind of in the same way to say like poverty follows from abortion and abortion follows from you just don't believe the right things yet or you're not Christian enough yet. And so the answer is to be more Christian. They made it into a black and white moral issue.
Right.
When in fact, previously it used to be connected the dots to poverty. To say poverty.
Exactly.
People who are in poverty will tend to have more abortions because they don't feel like they can take care of this kid. They don't have enough money.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Either that or just women are more vulnerable when they're in poverty. And so they're, you know, they may feel like I need to be with my boyfriend for my physical safety, for my wages. Right.
Yeah. I mean,
on average, women are paid lower than men at just kind of in general. So,
yeah,
absolutely.
So I hear you saying you wrote it because you care about this issue, and that you noticed that a lot of the way that the policy sort of recommendations were all kind of clumped together, it was becoming self-defeating, almost like the phrase that comes to mind is an empty signifier, where it was like this, like how I vote on abortion is sort of this stamp that I show the world or show myself even to be like, I'm doing the right thing here by voting in this way or by advocating for this policy. When in fact, if you actually look at the results of those policies, it's doing the opposite of what we purport to be saying it's going to be doing, which is reducing abortions.
Yes.
It's actually raising them.
Yes, yeah. It is. And you know, economics is a big part of it. Contraception is the other part of it. So, you know, we heard a lot about repeal and replace during the Trump administration of the ACA. And the ACA helpfully gave women contraception, which is another cost to women in their lives, right? Like men typically don't pay for contraception. And so to take that away would, especially IUDs and other high effective contraception, would drive the abortion rate up. And yet, the abortion rate came down the most during Obama's 8 years, primarily because of the ACA and contraceptive care.
Yeah. Yeah. So writing this book because you care about this and complexifying the issue because you actually do care about whether more abortion, you know what I mean? Like, we do care about, like, what? How do we actually get fewer abortions to happen?
Right.
And you have to look at, you have to complexify the issue from how it's been sort of handed to us by the evangelical, at least the evangelical church today.
Absolutely.
In order to actually get at that.
Ben, it goes back though to, and I'm wondering if Mako can speak to this, because you go into like the Hebrew words that are used in scripture, right? Can you speak a little bit to that for those who are kind of listening to say, well, what does the Bible say about this? Because I thought it was clear. And now you're kind of saying, maybe it's not as clear as I thought.
Right. The most important biblical text is Exodus 21, verses 22 to 25. And what we know about that text is it's an example case law of like, you know, when this happens, do this. And so when this, the when this happens is when two men are fighting and a woman gets between them, presumably because she's the wife of one of the guys and she's coming to, you know, help her husband. Deuteronomy 25 also describes that scenario from a different angle. But the idea is she is struck and that's what we know for sure. What we're not sure about, although there's more clarity than I'm currently saying, but what we're not sure about is, okay, she has this miscarriage or something happens with the baby, with the unborn child, and then what do we do? And the Greek Septuagint version of the Exodus passage, which is important, right? Because the Greek Septuagint is the most quoted version of the Old Testament in the New Testament. It's preferred. It seems to have won the approval of the Jewish synagogue leadership, including the Sanhedrin, right? So this is an important manuscript family. What it says is, well, you look at whether the fetus is imperfectly formed or perfectly formed. And what they mean by that is, what's the age of the fetus? And what do those terms mean? Well, we're not totally sure. But Jewish commentary like Philo and others received that and said, all right, well, let's do something. Let's say something about that. What are those markers? And an imperfectly formed fetus would be a fine. So the offender pays a fine. The a perfectly formed fetus, which presumably would be older, would be kind of the lex talionis principle, life for life, eye for eye, and that kind of thing, and which I've addressed on another podcast of ours as
yes.
That's a proportionate payment about like what it means to lose a life or what it means to lose a functioning eye, you know, or something like that. But the fact that there are different punishments means that there is an early stage to the pregnancy where the fetus does not count as a fully human person.
Yeah. And the punishment is less because of that.
Exactly.
So no matter where they, so the Bible doesn't necessarily say kind of where that line is, but just the fact that there were two different consequences for, you know, one kind of fetus and another kind shows us that this has not been as clear, maybe scripturally or in terms of how we have interpreted scripture in church history. It hasn't been as clear as maybe we think.
Right.
Hey everyone, this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast is brought to you in part by Respero. Respero seeks to bring healing to hurting people through life-changing conversations. Respero offers the opportunity to be trained as a lay counselor, enabling you to provide help to people in your communities. If you're interested in becoming a counselor or wondering if it might be a good fit, check out Respero's Understanding People course, the first step to joining Respero's counseling team. Founder Joe Bishop leads every cohort of counselors in training and continues to provide oversight. Once the courses are completed, Respero also offers an array of personal development courses and lessons covering topics ranging from anger and anxiety to codependency and spiritual abuse, something we've talked about quite often on this podcast. If you're interested in learning more about how you relate to yourself and others, consider taking the Understanding Yourself course. You can find Respero on social media at Respero Restoring Hope or online at respero.org. That's R-E-S-P-E-R-O.org. We'll hope you'll join them in their mission of bringing hope to a hurting and chaotic world.
We don't let anyone sponsor our podcast, Ben.
But nope. Yeah, you can't just come in here and give us money.
No.
That's not how this works.
No way. No way. We've turned away thousands, but not Respero. Their vision and mission align very closely with what we're doing. We encourage you to check it out.
Yeah. Yeah, especially now. I'm glad that they had contacted us now. I mean, we were just talking in the intro. We were just talking recently about how it, just how crazy and chaotic this past year has been with the pandemic and with everything else going on. So mental health is high on everybody's radar. I think Respero can offer some help in that regard. Yeah. And also the training as a lay counselor is intriguing to me as well.
Yeah.
In terms of just being able to, you know, not just understand yourself a bit better, but be able to have better conversations with others and help others.
Yep. You want to become more like Jesus, understand yourself and understand people better. Check it out.
R-E-S-P-E-R-O.org, Respero. Thanks for sponsoring this episode of the podcast, guys.
This podcast is brought to you by Gravity Leadership Academy, our 10-month online training intensive for Christian leaders who want to root their life and leadership in God's love and bring lasting transformation to their culture. In Gravity Leadership Academy, you'll learn the real-life practicalities of how to notice God's presence and activity in and around you so you can participate more fully in God's life and mission and open up space for those around you to do so too. We've worked really hard to make this training in missional leadership practical and doable. To find out more about Gravity Leadership Academy, visit gravityleadership.com/academy.
I'm not sure how much in your book you go into this, but this is the same with early Christianity too. Like what I was told was early church fathers, early Christians were always against abortion, and they point to the didache of like setting out babies to be exposed in terms like that. But what sure. I came to realize is exactly what you're talking about, that there was a much deeper lexicon of talking about what kind of human life are we talking about when it comes to an embryo, a fetus, a partially formed fetus, a fully formed fetus, and then a baby that's been born. And what I discovered, right, to my shock, utter shock, was that throughout the church history, Gregory of Nyssa, Augustine, even Aquinas, they're able to delineate between a not fully formed human person in the womb and a more fully formed human person in the womb. And that seemed to, that there seemed to be some kind of moral obligation that changed based upon where the life was in that range. And in our current discussion about abortion,
right,
that's completely missing and completely lacking. Do I have that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll throw in another complication, which is the Hebrew Masoretic text, which, you know, most Protestants use and so on, that most interpreters of that, it says something different than the Greek Septuagint. It says basically personhood begins at birth. Yeah. The idea is, you know, just as when the baby breathes in air, yeah, it's like Adam, right, you know, breathing in the breath of God. And now there are some, like starting with John Calvin and some English interpreters who say, well, but maybe that's actually an early delivery that is a healthy baby and things like that. I argue, and most will say, no, that's not how the Jewish community received, mm-hmm, that. You can tell by the Targums, which were companion guides to synagogue, mm-hmm, readings of the Hebrew Masoretic and the Greek Septuagint, that either they said imperfectly formed versus perfectly formed, so you're looking at the age of the fetus, or they're just saying birth constitutes personhood. Mm-hmm. And so going to your point, Matt, yeah, the early Christians weren't totally sure what to do there, mm-hmm, because this is the single most important text, right? Like you could look at Psalm 139 and he made me in my mother's womb, but that's still too general. It's indeterminate. Mm-hmm. Like here is in Exodus, it's a specific ethical situation where they're discerning what is the status of fetal life, mm-hmm, and we don't exactly know. Mm-hmm. Like it's just impossible to tell between these two manuscripts. And so yeah, the early Christians, you know, you have to look at the whole collection of statements that they make about the subject, and also what manuscript are they wrestling, mm-hmm, with. They basically say, you know, I mean, Scripture itself raises this question. Clearly, we're supposed to care about, yeah, this, but we don't know even what formed or unformed mean, like in the more demanding of the, yeah, manuscripts. So the West looked at the Latin West, which became the Roman Catholic tradition, Augustine, Aquinas, as you said, they basically they say, we'll go with Aristotle, because Aristotle's the leading scientist on this.
Oh,
so he had studied miscarriages and said, you know, the baby, the fetus is formed somewhere between 40 and 90 days of life. And that became this marker that Catholics were then comfortable saying ensoulment happens when maybe halfway through the pregnancy, when the mother feels the baby kick in the womb. That is what we believe about ensoulment. And it's related to the physical development of the fetus, not completely identical with it, but, you know, there it is. And it's related to the Septuagint version of Exodus 21, even though the Catholics went with the Vulgate, which is based on the Hebrew Masoretic. It's just incredible. Mm-hmm. But then the Greek Orthodox and the Syrian, so then there's the Greek Orthodox and then there's the Syrian East. And they have different positions about it. The Syrian East says, basically, let's just use the Septuagint. And we'll adopt that distinction. Basil of Caesarea, representing now the Eastern Orthodox position, he and others are trained doctors, so they took the Hippocratic Oath. Hippocrates did not want to perform abortion. So they just adopt that, and they say, yeah, sure. We don't know about fetal life, but we have this practice about abortion that we want to honor, and there are reputable Greek doctors doing this. So they even drew from different scientific sources.
Yeah. Yeah. So all of this to say then, this isn't a way of like not caring about abortion, right? This isn't a way of saying, well, who cares then? You know, like let the abortions flow, you know? I mean, not to be too crass about it. Like this isn't a way of doing that. This is a way of properly caring about this issue and saying like, what do we actually know about this?
Yes.
And how have we actually been shooting ourselves in the foot by oversimplifying this issue?
Marco, maybe as a pivot between scripture and church tradition and how we find ourselves where we are now, which earlier you said we end up supporting policies that increase abortions, and we tell ourselves that we're pro-life when really we're supporting things that enable or don't reduce abortions. I want to read just this paragraph from an article about the rise of the religious right, and I would love for you then to riff on it, if that's okay. Today, evangelicals make up the backbone of the pro-life movement, but that hasn't always been so. Both before and for several years after Roe versus Wade, evangelicals were overwhelmingly indifferent to the subject of abortion, which they considered a, quote, Catholic issue. In 1968, for instance, a symposium sponsored by the Christian Medical Society and Christianity Today, the flagship magazine of evangelicalism, refused to characterize abortion as sinful, citing, quote, individual health, family welfare, and social responsibility as justifications for ending a pregnancy. In 1971, delegates to the Southern Baptist Convention in St. Louis, Missouri, passed a resolution encouraging, quote, Southern Baptists to work for legislation that will allow the possibility of abortion under such conditions as rape, incest, clear evidence of severe fetal deformity, and carefully ascertained evidence of the likelihood of damage to the emotional, mental, and physical health of the mother. The convention, hardly a redoubt of liberal values, reaffirmed that position in 1974, 1 year after Roe, and again in 1976. So I just want to, I hold that out to say this non-black and white, we need to have a real ethical conversation about what abortion is and what it isn't. This existed within our Christian tradition until the mid-70s. Christianity Today, Southern Baptists. I mean, these aren't mainline organizations. These are sort of the bread and butter of evangelicalism. Until the mid-70s, we're able to talk publicly and openly about how abortion is complicated, and there maybe are some allowances, et cetera, et cetera. What has happened, Mako? Like, why are we now, less than 50 years later, almost unable to even put a podcast out about it because we're so circumspect that we're going to, you know, ruin everything?
Right. And by the way, the emotional and mental health of the mother is the most generous criteria for allowing exceptions.
Yes, it's not even like, you know, early abortion, or if the mother's going to die. This is like basically like if the mom, you know, can't support this child, or if the mom has mental health issues, or right?
right. And, you know, and in the literature about before Roe v. Wade, what did women say in order to procure abortions? They could always say, "This is just really hard. I didn't expect to have, you know." I don't think they were lying, but you know, those were the reasons that doctors found acceptable. Right. So what changed was in 1979, there was a a movement called the Moral Majority. I think it was founded by Jerry Falwell Sr. with the help of two, especially these two men, Republican strategists who were Catholics, named Richard Vigeri and Paul Weyrich. And they figured out that demographically, they wanted to realign the Republican Party and away from the northern industrialists and towards the, you know, who were moderate on economic issues, towards the, the southern white supremacists. So the Dixiecrats who were leaving the Democratic Party because of LBJ's Great Society and the civil rights legislation, they were leaving the Republican, the Democratic Party and looking for the Republican Party to be their home. And this was kind of the main thing that drew white evangelicals into national politics. They had already really been in state level politics because they were busy resisting Brown v. Board. They had set up segregation academies and so on. And then Jimmy Carter said, we're going to bring an end to that by making your segregated academies, your private Christian white schools, not tax exempt because you're not following federal law. And that just drove them nuts. So
Bob Jones, I think, is one of those places, right? Bob Jones University.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And I want to point out that this is Christian versus Christian in public debate, as far as debate, right? Because Jimmy Carter is self-described as
born again
evangelical. Yep. So this is, and he's a Georgian, right? So this is a Southerner versus a Southerner on these things. And that's important because that's a pattern in U.S. history that we don't often reckon with, that the major policy disagreements are Christian versus Christian, you know, slavery versus abolition, or theocracy versus a principled pluralism, going all the way back to John Winthrop versus Roger Williams. The same is true for Roe v. Wade. Roe v. Wade looked at all of the state-level laws, and it was a mess. Because some states, like in the North, had in the late 1800s become more strict on the surface, even though they were largely driven by doctors who wanted to rule out the quacks who gave poisons to women, right? So the doctors actually still performed abortions in their own clinics. They just didn't want women to be poisoned. They also wanted to monopolize the field. I mean, for good reasons, they were the legitimate doctors. But also in the North, there were the anti-Catholic sentiment with the Know Nothing Party. That they were the anti-immigrants, and so they looked at all these Catholics coming in from Italy, Ireland, and Germany, and saying, "We're going to be outnumbered." There was fear of race suicide, not in terms of pure whiteness, but in terms of Protestant. Anglo-Saxon whiteness. They were like, we're going to be replaced by these white Catholics. And so let's stop doing abortions. Even though that never really worked, no one stopped doing abortions. But that was in the North. The South continued to hold to quickening after the Civil War and after Reconstruction. Why? Because it served anti-blackness. Because white men raped black women with impunity, and They didn't want to have those children anymore because you couldn't enslave them. So they're not economic commodities. And then if white women had mixed race children or had gotten involved with a man who was not white, then the family would want her to abort the fetus of that union. And so it's fascinating because the pro-life movement today portrays the situation as if there was just, oh, we learned from science and we changed state laws in response to what we knew from science, that Aristotle was, you know, that the best we could do at the time, but he was wrong. And so we're going to go with, you know, fertilization and conception as the start of personhood. No, actually, that's not how it worked out. Abortion policy has always been weaponized for some other goal, either anti-immigrant politics in the North or anti-black politics in the South. And so the Supreme Court looks at this and says, it's a mess. So, and besides that, the 14th Amendment seems to take higher priority because we got to equalize treatment on some level of both mothers, fetuses, and so on, and the healthcare community. Like, what can they expect? And so they look back to 1787. What was the understanding of abortion at the time of the writing of the Constitution? Well, it was quickening, and abortion was permitted until quickening. And quickening also is this weird evidentiary hurdle, right? Because it depends on the mother saying, yeah, I felt the baby kick, which, you know, how often is that going to be? So the law itself was more designed to protect women from men who wanted to force them to get abortions.
Wow.
It's just fascinating. So Roe v. Wade is a return to some respect for quickening, and that was a Christian position for the Christian West for over a millennium and a half.
Yes, Mako. Right? Mako. I want to put it. You are giving us like a masterclass here. And I remember when I first heard all this, I literally did not believe it. I could not believe that. I mean, what you said really clearly was, and this is a matter of public record, you can Google the Southern Strategy and read the Wikipedia page on it, where the head of the Republican National Convention owns that this was an explicit strategy, that there were a bunch of disenfranchised, disillusioned white supremacists in the South who were mad at the Democratic Party because of the Great Society stuff, Lyndon Baines Johnson, the Civil Rights Act and all that, and were looking to keep the federal government out of their institutions, out of schools, right, and other places, swimming pools, et cetera.
Right.
And there was this millions of people who could be galvanized, but because of where America was in the 70s, you couldn't just say, hey, we'll hate black people too. Vote for us. So there had to be these, what do you want to call them? Like signifiers or code words, right? That would give, that let everybody know, we're going to let you be as racist as you want to be. and you can trust us to protect your, for instance, states' rights. Or we are the limited federal government party, which meant we'll keep the federal government out of local policies that enable you to, for instance, continue to disallow interracial dating. Right?
Sure.
And so what you're saying, Mako, is that abortion became a rallying cry to bring those people into one solidified partisan camp, whereas they had been in various camps or various places otherwise.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
Now this, honestly, I'd never heard this. Chris, did you ever hear this stuff growing up?
No. In fact, it's interesting to me that like now it is like the voting policy thing that people are one policy voters, right? And it's on this issue.
Right.
And so, no, I think for our listeners, I'm like, wait a minute, this is bananas, right? I just got like a crash history course that opened my eyes wide. And I'm wondering, Mako, if you can just talk a little bit to our listener who's sitting there going, wait a minute, this is all new to me. I do care about abortion, but help my imagination grow to what is pro-life? Like, give me a bigger vision of not just abortion, but what does it look like to love people and be pro-life as a whole?
That's the great question. And it's a challenge, but in general, I would refer to how the New Deal Catholics, the Catholic Democrats, thought about it. It's kind of the seamless garment of life, right? From womb to tomb type of care, right? So when a baby's born, we care about nutrition, we care about physical health, we care about early education, we care about services, to that child and to the family. And if something is going wrong or needs to be addressed in terms of mental health. I mean, let's talk about autism or things like that. And then strong public education. And then, how can we contain the cost of living? How do we put regulations on banks so that they don't drive us more and more into debt? I mean, all of these things were part of a consistent pro-life platform. But what happened in the 80s was that when the pro-life cause became a absorbed by the Republicans, it got wedded to a criminal justice orientation rather than a social welfare orientation. Hmm. So it's like, who can we punish? Hmm. Right. And yes. So, when Trump said, I think it was back in 2016 when he was running, like the woman should be punished. Everyone gasped because technically conservatives are supposed to say, no, she's the secondary victim. The doctor is the main culprit. Mm-hmm. Like the, let's take away a doctor's license if he or she performs an abortion. So, but then there are actually organizations like Personhood USA or, lobbyist groups that are mostly Christian who do want to punish the mother for getting an abortion. And we have instances like Bebe Shui, and I talk about specific cases in the book of women who were prosecuted because they killed a fetus alongside their suicide attempts.
Oh gosh. Wow.
And then they go to prison
for murder.
So there is a retributive mood or a mood among some to only view abortion through the lens of a criminal justice mindset, yeah. where we want to only protect the baby until the unborn until it's born, and then we want to stop welfare pay. We want to dismantle regulation yeah. because it becomes about individual freedom and choice yeah. and. Again, it's the pro-life cause is wedded to an economic conservatism. Yeah. But I explain in the book why many reasons why that's self-defeating, and including all kinds of other chemicals from big chemical companies, where chemicals are landing in the wombs of mm-hmm. mothers against her will, against her wishes, and it's causing spina bifida, it's causing autism. And yet we expect parents of these kids to have to deal with these conditions without support.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So I hear you saying, number one, I mean, if you do want to know more of the history, read the book. Yeah. So order Mako's yeah. book and read it. We'll put a link in the show notes to your book. But basically, like, shifting from viewing this through the lens of crime and punishment, let's make it illegal and let's punish people who do it, and shifting right. into a social welfare mindset, which is more practically oriented to say, how can we get less abortions to happen? And how can we care for, right. and part of that would be, let's make women feel like it's possible to have a baby. Like let's right. help them feel like that is something that they could do, right? Mm-hmm. Let's give them support. Let's give them enough economic, and so beginning to think through all of those things means, I hear you saying that it's not just voting for the right candidate every 4 years, right? For president, right. that the president has very little real life effect on kind of the day-to-day happenings in the world of actual abortions and that kind of a thing. And so there's a lot more that can be done.
That's right.
On the local That's level. Right. There's a lot more that can be done on the state level. There's a lot more that can be done just in our relationships. Like there's a lot that can be done if we can shift from that crime and punishment mentality into a social welfare mentality.
Right. And I just want to add that in the early church, the bishops starting around the 4th century, when the empire started to become Christian, I mean, depending on mm-hmm. how you think about that, but the bishops would mm-hmm. say, sure, we don't like infanticide or abortion, but if the parents are in poverty, we understand, and we're not yeah. going to hold them to church discipline because poverty is something that, kind of trumped the other factors. Mm-hmm. And so sure, I mean, there are some diehards, right, who look at early church history and say, look at how the Christians stood up against abortion. And that's generally true. And you know, it sparked a revolution in how we think about children and children as people. So sure, that's really important. But yet, look at also how they looked at the family as a unit, how they looked at relational ethics and relational notions of justice. It wasn't, they did not look at it as an individualistic issue or as a criminal justice problem.
That's really helpful, Mako.
It is.
Just be willing to let your views on this be complexified a little bit for the sake of truth and for the sake of, for the sake of life.
Yeah.
And
I'll just say what appealed to me about this book, Mako, is that I know of dozens of Christians who feel constrained by their conscience to vote for a single issue because that's how they were raised and they were taught. Mm-hmm. And I know there must be thousands or millions of those people. And then also there's hundreds and hundreds of pastors who pastor people who feel constrained by their conscience. And this perhaps aligned, this was maybe okay 15 years ago, you know, just to speak candidly, like for people who voted for George H. Bush, you know, there wasn't a whole bunch of like things that were outwardly offensive about that man. And there was maybe not as many awarenesses or awakenings about, maybe they weren't as conflicted, but I know so many people who talked about holding their nose and voting for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And they did that because they felt like they had to make a stand for the unborn and for life. Mm-hmm. I think what I want to say unequivocally is your book helps us detangle the myth of the single issue voting. It helps us detangle the myth of a single Christian position on this issue. And it helps us, if we really want to reduce the number of unborn lives that are lost, it helps us untangle how do we actually do that? Is that safe to say that?
Absolutely. And it makes us care about all children in a totally different way.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to, as long as my children, you know, and then how other people treat their children, I'm going to judge that. So and it's much more holistic. You know, when we look at abortion stats today and ask questions like, okay, when 14% of all abortions are procured by married women, there's something about the conservative assumption that just being married
that'll prevent it.
We'll solve the issue of abortion. Or we look at, the Midwest, where I know you guys are there, where when jobs leave this country, men are less likely to propose and get married. Mm-hmm. Okay, that is sure to impact abortion rates. Yeah. And so, in order to care about this, we have to care about everything. But I think it's true that, you know, it's all interconnected and that if you care about this, then you ought to care about everything.
Yeah. Yes. Well, amen to that. Mako, it's been great to have you on the podcast again. The book is called Abortion Policy and Christian Social Ethics in the United States. We will put a link to that in the show notes. And a link to your Anastasis Center. You pronounce it Anastasis or Anastasis?
Anastasis.
I was noticing the little accent mark over that second A. But anyway, the Anastasis Center, we'll put a link to that. Mako, where else can people find you? On the social medias? You exist out there in the world?
Yes. So I have two Facebook pages. People can find me at the one that is dedicated to discussion of this book.
Oh, there's one. Okay.
And that'll be obvious. And Twitter and Instagram. So
okay, just
I look forward to engaging.
Awesome. Well, it was great to have you. And I really appreciate you spending some time with us, walking us through this very complex issue.
Thank you so much for having me. So appreciate you all.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Our show is produced by Ben Sternke, Matt Tebby, and Ben Hardman. Aaron Sternke does our mixing and mastering. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com. If you find our podcast helpful, share it with your friends in person and on social media. And don't forget to rate and review us online, as well as subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can join our Gravity community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join. And hey, we'd love to hear from you. Ask a question, make a comment, send us an idea, a recommendation, recipe, whatever. You can email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.